Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we seek to recover faith by recovering the faith.
Yep.
And we are talking about Nathan's book, Essential Faith.
Mm.
And the subtitle is The One Element Necessary for Life.
Yeah.
And we're coming toward the end of the book, and he has, at the end of his book, four exhortations.
Yeah. I try to get real.
He does. He tries to put boots on the ground.
Yes.
There at the end of the book. Let's do a quick overview. What are those four exhortations?
Good questions. Let me see. What did I say they were? Let's see. Evangelize, don't proselytize.
Number one.
Yes.
Number two is?
Retool discipleship.
Retool discipleship. Number three?
That's right. Adore Christ as one flesh.
One flesh. Adore Christ. Okay. Evangelize, disciple, adore Christ, one flesh. And the fourth one is?
Let God rule his kingdom.
Interesting. Let God rule his kingdom.
Yes.
Intriguing. Okay. Number one.
Mm-hmm.
Evangelize. Yes. Don't proselytize. What does that mean, proselytize?
Ah, yes.
Proselytization is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's where you try to steal the sheep from other folds to come over and be
sheep.
Your sheep.
Yeah. I think Modi in India and Hindu... I think, we talked about how the Hindus actually retain more of that better than any other religion. And there's probably some reasons for that. One of those being it's very wound into what it means to be Indian. And
right.
I don't know if that just began with like this major split against what it means to be Pakistani. So you have two people that are ethnically identical. Racially, genetically, and yet one would consider themselves Indian, the other not. So, and I think that some of that's wound up into what it means to be Indian is to be a Hindu. And so, their language is Hindi, at least one major language. So it's, if you're a politician, speaking of politics and religion, right?
Mm.
You need a society that is cohesive, that shares assumptions. Mm-hmm. If you have people that are not part of that, at least makes your job a lot easier. feel sorry for these people that have to run countries that are pluralistic.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a bad way because we have to lean more heavily on laws, legal system, jurisprudence. Coming up with precedents and stuff like that, basically making it up as we go, as opposed to being given an assumed code of ethics. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, there's been a real concern, I think, on Modi's part about proselytization. And so that would be the language they would use. I don't think it's meant to be pejorative. It's just basically it's seen as the attempt to, as you say, abscond with people, maybe kidnap someone's mind, if you will, if you're looking at it from the perspective of the
victim.
Yeah, the one that's in the established religion seeing his family member leave.
Mm.
Now
you might call that event, like if you're saying, now is he talking about what, Christians or Muslims proselytizing Hindus?
Yes. Yeah. Anybody proselytizing Hindus, not like he's saying, hey, leave those Muslims alone, we don't want you taking away, because that, again, that's, that's this thing that brings cohesion to the group and allows order in society. When you start messing with that, you're really, you're committing almost a treasonous act, I think, if you have that mentality, right?
Mm-hmm.
So... we put people to death for treason. So people have long been put to death for this sort of behavior and actions. Now, from his perspective, how somebody is taken away from Hinduism into another religion is immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the setting out to abscond with somebody, say spiritually, is very close to what I think Jesus was condemning in his woes to the Pharisees. So that's kind of where I begin. And I've always been confused by it. Jesus, he has these seven woes in Matthew 23, and he's basically beating them up for hypocrisy, right? You make long prayers and for You know, and then you foreclose on widows' homes and these kinds of things, okay? And so he's showing their inconsistency, but one of those among the list is you encompass sea and land to make one proselyte. And when he is converted or when he's made, you make him twice as much the son of hell as yourselves. You know, so, boy, that's just a lot to unpack there. What exactly is he indicting? At the very least, we can say there's a wrong way to mm-hmm. make disciples.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a proselyte in that instance seems to just be a convert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So proselytization in that instance seems to be the same as evangelism. You're going out to get a convert.
Yes.
The yeah. problem is they make him into a son of hell.
Right, yeah.
Twice as much the son of hell as you are.
Yeah, yeah. So, man, that's just kind of mean. I mean, it's almost like he's starting with the assumption that they're sons of hell, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's like, yep. Okay, well, we can all agree that you're sons of hell, but now let's talk about the problem when you go make mm-hmm. proselytes, you know, and they're like, what? You know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we wouldn't consider somebody... I think about Adoniram Judson, who I don't think is an example of what's wrong, but I think if I looked at his life, I would say, here's someone who spent a lot, and he paid a high price mm-hmm. for very little in terms of converts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like he went to China, right? And like his wife died, and his kids died or something.
Yeah, everybody died. I think it was Burma or Bangladesh, uh-huh. one of those ones that started with a B back mm-hmm. in the day. And I think it was Burma.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they were just, I mean, they just faced, it was just like a wall. They just couldn't get through. Yeah, his wife died of illness. I mean, he was translating a copy of the Bible and it was lost or stolen somehow. You know, he had to start over. I mean, he mm-hmm. just, so many, just to, when you read his story, it's just almost, it's demoralizing and probably more typical than most of us know because most of the time they're not published. Mm-hmm. But it's incredible. It's just a grind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes people go over there and everything's great and everybody repents. And but for him, it was a grind. But we look at him and we read books about him. We talk about him. We say, well, here's an example of faith. You know, here's somebody who just really stuck it out. And and that's good. It would be difficult for us to, I think, just start criticizing mission agencies. You know? Let's just go through and have a write-up, you know, on these guys.
Right. But here's Jesus saying, woe to you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what are we going to say? They work too hard. You know, we hate them. But that's what Jesus says. I mean, what's really wrong with what they did? I mean, within, leaving out all the assumptions, just within, because all of his statements kind of stand alone, you know, as he's indicting them, you know. They all, he gives the reason why what they're doing is wrong, you know. So he says, you tithe all these herbs from your garden, you know, you're counting the seeds that'll come from your, whatever, your fennel and or whatever you had at the time. And you're making sure you get set 10 aside, okay. So that seems pretty fastidious. That seems pretty conscientious. And yet, you know, he says that you ignore matters of like mercy and faithfulness. Okay, so we know it's wrong to ignore matters like mercy and faithfulness. We don't wonder, what did they do wrong exactly, you know? where he says, you're careful to wash everything. You know, you go through all these washing rituals, but on the inside, you're full of self-indulgence and greed. Okay, we know that's bad. Okay, like all of them are obvious what's wrong, right? He's showing mm-hmm. a juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm.
But here, we don't really know, you know, like he just assumes it, right? But I would suggest that it is the amount of effort to make one proselyte that suggests that they are children of hell. And not only that, but how it is that that second generation, the proselyte they've made, has become a child of, twice as much a child of hell, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, if we agree with the assumptions at the beginning of my book of Essential Faith, that we are saved from this present evil age or a society that would conform us and control us, mm-hmm. okay? So, this convert has resulted from an inordinate amount of energy spent by the ones doing the conversion.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So what drives, what's the engine that drives all of this behavior? You know, it could be a religious drive, maybe. But if I set out to make a proselyte, okay, I'm willing to do what it takes. Okay, so I don't know if you've gone to any church growth seminars or evangelism workshops, mm-hmm. or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Without naming names or whatever, what's been your impression, plus or minus, on any of the evangelistic methods or workshop kind of things that you've seen or done? Are you familiar with those?
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, sometimes, I guess, you know, in my long life, there have been approaches that are more like, and maybe I was trained to do this, maybe I just kind of picked it up from other people who were doing it. You know, there's been approaches that were like, you know, more what we might call contact evangelism, where you just meet a stranger and try to strike up a conversation, uh-huh. and you're trying to work that into the conversation. And of course, there's other approaches that are more relational.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with the people that are in your life, and how can you have conversations and preparing you to have that conversation, mm-hmm. presenting the gospel. And then, of course, there's the mission work stuff, where you're really preparing to go to the other side of the world, lift up, pack up your life and move.
Mm-hmm.
And live with the people and work with the people.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that is can be a major concern when it comes to evangelism is the overemphasis on how I present myself.
Uh-huh.
So the attempt to show, well, and my exposure with the Baptists, we talked more about our witness.
So our testimony?
My testimony or whatever, right? How my life represents Jesus in a positive light for the purpose of evangelism or making disciples, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when I say evangelism, I mean proselytization. Yeah, that's irony, is it? But we've got to make a distinction between these two words. So proselytization, I would say, is an attempt to make, to convince someone to believe in Christ, right? Now, that involves sharing the message, but a lot of the heavy lifting is on the individual doing the evangelizing, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's my efforts, and would you say it also entails to make people like me?
Perhaps, or at least like the pastor. I mean, without a doubt, that's what happens. You know, I think we've spoken before about these pictures of the graduating class of the Mukambe mission training work, right?
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a bunch of
African tribal
guys all in white Oxford shirts with mm-hmm. ties. And, you know, people mm-hmm. have gladly donated of their means to make sure all these people dressed like mm-hmm. Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. What is that? Why is that? Because that's how preachers dress. It's like, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. how do we get to that place? Where did that even come up? And it's something very wound very closely into our souls, into our psyche, who we are. But yeah, there are a lot of dynamics that go into making proselytes that don't go into evangelism. Okay. So, evangelism proper, I would say evangelism as used in the New Testament is the proclamation, just a simple proclamation of the message about Christ. Now, that may involve a little bit of backstory or something, kind of like in the New Tribes approach, where they go and they story through the Bible, because you are catching people unawares. You know, they just don't know any, they don't have any context. Giving people context, I think, can be helpful and good. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be like with the Peace Child, that the context is already there and you have to find a way to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Don Richardson's Peace Child, he goes to reach this tribal people that are both headhunters and cannibals, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. The fact that he went, you know, is kind of laudable in a way, but he's trying to reach these people. One of their great values is hypocrisy or subterfuge, you know, basically tricking someone to the point of taking something from them, very important, even their life. So, and that would be the hero of the story. So when they hear about the story of Jesus, Judas is the hero. Mm-hmm. So here are some people who are pretty far away from accepting this message. And then he discovers that they had they had a mechanism in their society where they are able to negotiate peace with a warring tribe by the giving of a son to the other tribe's chief as, you know,
peace offering.
A peace offering, but also just a guarantee, right? Mm. So we're not going to invade you, or you're going to kill my son. So I'm vulnerable to you in some way, right? So anyway, he was able to use that in their society and explain how God gave his son to make peace with us, etc., right? Mm-hmm. And which led to the conversion of the tribe. So his contention would be that God's already been at work there, and we just had to find that and join him, which I think typifies what I'm trying to say. You know, that what we've, I think, a lot of well-intentioned but unfortunately poor misguided attempts at evangelism in the past have been come and bring resources. You know, mm-hmm. build hospitals and, you know, infrastructure, schools, etc., and then bring the gospel in along with that. And what that, I think, has done is it's created in the other people a desire to just join up for the sake of all of the material benefits mm-hmm. that come with it, mm-hmm. which would be very similar, I think, to what is going on when Jesus is indicting, when he calls out the Pharisees, is that when you have a group of people who are seen as the righteous ones, right, mm-hmm. and they're paying a ton of attention to you for some reason, right, mm-hmm. It's easy to be flattered. It's easy to imagine that you can be an insider, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm put in mind of someone that I know that, you know, he was just a blue-collar worker, didn't have a very wide sphere of influence, but was invited to the Masonic Lodge and has just been all in, you know, and it was around that same time he started going to church too. But it almost seems like he's more into the Masonic Lodge than into church. And when you talk to him about it, he's like, oh, there was this guy there and this guy there and this guy there, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's someone that had something like a conversion experience, and then he's changed his clothing, he's changed his routine, he's changed to some degree his priorities, his emphasis, because he has been accepted into a group of people who maybe have more cred than he does, even. Mm-hmm. You know, that they're having a high opinion of him is worth more than his family having a high opinion of him or something like that. So that can be a very powerful influence. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid that we fall victim mm-hmm. to that. So, I don't know. Can you think of ways that that in the Christian movement in America today, we try to ingratiate ourselves or somehow win over people in, you know, under the guise at least, or at least as an attempt to make new Christians? What do you think?
Well, I was having a conversation with my friend the other day, and he was kind of describing his church, which was a big presentation, a big production, and real slick. And he was afraid that some of the folks coming were excited to be there because they're down and out, they're poor, and it makes them feel better to be part of this thing that's showy and successful.
Yeah.
And he wasn't indicting their motives entirely. He was just afraid that it has that it does affect people in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so one sure way to build a large church is to have a youth ministry that is led by a very charismatic individual or couple. Because parents will go where their kids are, and the kids will go where the group is, and the group will be where the cool people are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, one of the beautiful things in the case I've been making throughout is that the gospel brings people of different socioeconomic backgrounds mm-hmm. together, and mm-hmm. that's good. But when that becomes the engine that we use, when we are, you know, when we actually design it, you know, so that we leverage that, you know, just remember conversations in church staffs. It's like, you've got to have somebody leading the youth ministry who's cool, who's charismatic. You can't have, you know, the nerd, or you're not going to have it. You're not going to have a youth ministry. That's just how it is. Now, why do we focus on youth in that way? Well, yes, the parents go where the kids are, but why the youth? Because they're more susceptible to these dynamics than adults are. And so that it can be a concern for me, from my perspective, you know, because when the group is our connection point, when we are swept into religious experiences or whatever, because that's where our friends are and things like that, that we're just as easily swayed in another direction when our perceived center, our social center shifts. And I think to some degree, that's how the internet has affected Christianity, is by giving a lot of young people a new social center, a virtual one, where now they have a group of folks who are aware of their behavior and their beliefs and everything and affecting those, but they're not the in-person group now. And youth group, you know, by default, it comes to an end. So if the young person's attachment was to that group, those leaders, those peers, and then there's obviously, you know, there's all of a sudden kind of a dispersal of that, what happens to that person? You know, my my daughter went to a charter school in Fayetteville, and she was saying, man, it's really weird. She's like, it's just like this school is just made up of, what was it? Like really, really churchy people and drug addicts. And I'm like, well, you should hang out with the drug addicts. You know, and I'm not, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely, because this approach can be so insidious and dangerous, I think, to our souls. It's going to necessarily leave us empty if we're not, because it's not sustainable. It's like those broken cisterns that we've talked about before, where Jeremiah laments toward Israel and says, you know, you've rejected me, the fountain of living waters, and you've hewn out for yourself cisterns, broken cisterns that can not hold water. So you have these man-made vessels for, let's just say, psychological nourishment, replenishment. But those take a lot of time, money, and energy, you know,
to maintain and keep going. So this is very closely related to the force of conformity that the gospel rescues us from.
Right.
And you're calling us to not go back to conformity. We've been rescued from conformity. Let's not use conformity and conforming pressures in reaching people.
Right. Because that next generation becomes even of a lower grade. They've only been connected, you know, like say we have mixed motives, you know, say we really love Jesus, but we also are going to do anything to make people believe in him, whether they want to or not. You know what I'm saying? Like we keep asking ourselves, hey, why don't more people believe in Jesus? You know, and then we try to come up with ways and we even look to marketing and sales, and we try to come up with things that are somewhat analogous to the sales approaches, right? And I mean, we would even back in the day when more cold evangelism, you would look at things like people who were going door to door to sell, you know, books or whatever, and what their success rate is, how they get the job done, you know, because sales is always going to be a hard thing. You just can't control what's on the other side, but you can do your darndest, you know, and in doing your darndest, you might be damned, you know what I'm saying? Or at least the next person might be, because you haven't done them any favors, really. And I think that that's where proselytizing can be an ugly, messy thing. It can be really depriving someone of their of their liberty, their agency, more than just leaving them alone, you know, more than other influences would do. And that can be, that's very troubling. And so we have to be careful. And what I would suggest is that if the gospel is enough, if we're not calling people to a behavioral standard or conforming to our set of morals. So if you look at certain, you know, and I mentioned before, like I think Saddleback had this baseball diamond thing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And discipleship happens as you come in and you first go to church, right? And then you become a member of the church, and then you serve in the church, and then you bring other people to the church. And that's discipleship, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that more when it comes to retooling discipleship. But we're moving people through a behavioral litany, I guess, or just a list. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you come back to where you started, so you don't really get anywhere. I guess you get points. That's what you get for walking in circles. You get a point. And at any rate, the... that approach seems to suggest that the gospel's not enough. If you had to have one thing in that mentality, what would it be? Right? The church. So because at every stage, at every base around the corner, it's just go to church, join the church, serve in church, bring people to church. Mm-hmm. What's being said at church is certainly important, but in that model, it's immaterial. Mm-hmm. A good case study in these dynamics is to go to the Mormon church where they don't have the other influence pushing back.
The gospel,
mm-hmm. right? They don't have any pretense of a direct relationship with God or freedom or whatever. All of that has been stripped from the religion, and all that's left is this this kind of, what would I call it, automaton, you know, that's there. Like this something that's this lifeless but moving entity. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in that, what you see is that they have a what's called like testimony Sundays or something. And they get up and they give their testimony. And their testimony isn't, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. It is, I know the church is true. Mm-hmm. That's their confession of faith, right? How did it become that? You know, why not say, oh, I know that the angel Moroni came to Joseph Smith in 1830 or whatever, you know, or I know that Joseph Smith is a prophet, you know, or whatever. Why is it I know the church is true? You know, it's really an attempt, or it is they're succeeding and not attempting, but to program a set of people to believe an organization and to participate in an organization, whatever that organization teaches now or in the future. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the organization becomes the critical part. And I think that's the same. Like, when I look in the book, the Galatian letter, what it appears to me as I'm reading somewhat between the lines is that, you know, it's difficult to get someone to agree to have the end of their penis cut off there, you know, mm-hmm. what I'm saying, their foreskin. Uh-huh. That would be a hard sell. Mm-hmm. Especially without any kind of good, decent anesthetic or anything else, you know. But we like making grand gestures and major sacrifices. A lot of that's because it gets this God off our back, right? It just give me a break, dude. I already went through something, right? So that's something. But the other is what I see there is that they were being courted. That this tendency that Jesus calls out was very much alive and well in Pisidian Antioch, where there was a very powerful Jewish contingent, clearly. Mm-hmm. If you read in Acts 13 and Paul's experience there, their ability to really marshal the whole town, even though they're a minority, against this group of people, mm-hmm. And have them thrown out. And so here's a very influential set of folk. Okay. Now, the Galatians, in following Paul, have left behind their inclusion in pagan society. but they have not gained the benefit of inclusion in Jewish society. Mm-hmm. And so here they are, outsiders. Now the Jews are offering to make them insiders again. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is go through. I mean, you already believe in our God. We think that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to read our scriptures? We'll read them to you. You know, you just have to go through an elective surgery. Mm-hmm. That seems like not that big an ask, really. I mean, to get your life back.
Yeah, so that was an appeal, mm-hmm. oddly, because it offered full inclusion, mm-hmm. membership, yeah. inclusion, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Belonging.
Now, Paul sees that as adultery. He says, I'm jealous over you with a godly jealousy because I betrothed you as a pure virgin to one. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Paul's the yenta, right? He's not the groom. Mm-hmm. He's just my matchmaker. Mm-hmm.
Matchmaker.
That's right.
Okay, got it.
These folks wanted to be the groom, mm-hmm. or at least the boyfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, he says it's great to be sought after zealously. Everybody likes that if it's for a good purpose. But these folks are seeking you. You know, they're making a big deal out of you, but not for a good end. They want to cut you off, he says.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Cut you off from Christ.
He likes his wordplay. Right? They want to cut you off. But not, you know, not from the world like Jesus does, right? But from Christ, so that you may be joined to them. And these dynamics are so insidious that the NIV translators say they want to cut you off from us so that you might be joined to them. That's not in the Greek. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They cast Paul as being concerned over these people's allegiance to him. Mm-hmm. Whereas he's like, no, I want you and Jesus to be together. This is why I was only there for a little while and I left, and I expect you to do well.
Mm-hmm. And you're not talking about you and Jesus alone, because a person could misunderstand everything you're
right.
saying, as if you're not advocating for the church,
right.
rather for individual isolated spirituality. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, not what you're saying.
Right, right. Well, and there's this... So for Paul, and again, Paul doesn't leave those relationships behind. He says, and I'm in Galatians 4 if you want to read that at some point, but you know, he says, look, become like me. He says, I'm concerned for you. And he says, become like me because I have become like you. When I was with you, I stopped in because of a problem in my flesh, right? And I think it was this eye problem that he had. And he says, and you didn't despise me. You accepted me as a messenger of God, right? And if you could have, you would have pulled out your own eyes and given them to me. He's like, I saw a group of people that, frankly, I think people were afraid of these Galatians. I think there's a reason that John Mark, who was their traveling companion, this young Jewish man who'd already gone through the island of Cyprus, Barnabas's hometown, evangelizing. They get closer to Saul's hometown there in southern Turkey. They go through maybe one town, and John Mark's like, you know, I didn't sign up for this, being with these Gentiles. This is not my bag. And he sails back to Jerusalem, and it's not under friendly circumstances, because later, Paul doesn't want to take him with him. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an ugly break. Mm-hmm. And so John Mark defects because they're going into this region. You know, this is something that a good Jew is just not going there. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this just really virtuous set of folk. Okay. It's just like going into deepest, darkest Newton County. You know what I'm saying? Like you're just going down in there and you know that that's just all meth labs and moonshine stills.
Rebel flags.
And this is just, you know, I mean, this is the heart and soul of the alt-right, and you're going to go and try to preach this message of love and inclusion and everything, right? And you know it's not going well. Just going back to Jerusalem, man. I didn't sign up for this. So that's the kind of people that Paul has walked into when he gets into Pisidian and Antioch. Okay, now you do have the respectable folk, and they're all the Jews. what happens is at first everybody's like, this is awesome, great. But the next week they realize, hey, wait a minute. People are really listening to this guy. You know, you can tell these Jews are jealous. They're upset. You know, what they've been trying to do, make proselytes all this time, has suddenly just happened. Okay? Mm-hmm. And not only so, but he's not making them be circumcised to come in. Oh my goodness, you know, you can see why they were enraged with him and why he, you know, had to flee that area. But when he left them, what he discovered with them was that they suddenly had this capacity to love because of this message. And as he says to them in Galatians 5:6, all that counts is faith working through love. You have that. You know, he's saying, you have everything that counts. Why in the world would you trade having everything that counts to getting on the bottom rung of a ladder that somebody's now telling you to climb? You know, you started at the top, fool. You know, what are you doing? Okay. But that starting at the top, it means showing grace. It means loving the other. It's just implicit, but it does. But we do that from freedom and not for the sake of some sort of a return and not primarily to the lost. You know, that most of the benevolence in the church, if you can, happens within the church because it is about, and we'll talk about this, about giving back to Christ, giving to him, and he permeates those who believe in him, not those who don't. Now, we certainly, because we are people of compassion and love and stuff, we're not going to go by somebody in trouble and just leave them, right? We're going to do what we can. But relief and benevolence as evangelism is inherently duplicitous. I'm sorry it is. You know, it just is. Now, if we can just love people because they're hurting, and if they just, you know, give us the middle finger as a thank you, then fine, you know. But this kind of laying down of oneself is very much within the church. So Paul goes on in Galatians 6 to kind of come to his point where he says, don't be deceived. God is not mocked. The one who sows to the flesh will from the flesh reap corruption or rot. The one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life, right? And then he says, so bear each other's burdens and in that way fulfill the law of Christ. That's how you reap. That's how you sow to the Spirit, right? But that's very much a personal, individual choice. It's a spiritual behavior. It's not motivated by social pressure. You want an example of somebody doing kindness within the church under social pressure? Look at Ananias and Sapphira. Mm-hmm. You know, and so here's this couple, and they get swept up in this movement where everybody's selling what they have and giving it to their brothers and sisters. Okay, but theirs is not genuine in that they withhold a portion, lie about it, say they gave the whole thing. Why would you do that unless you are concerned for what other people think? Mm-hmm. You know, you look at that and you say, well, man, I haven't seen a whole lot of people struck dead in church. It seems like a very severe response, but until we know what's at stake, you know, what's at stake is the whole gospel, man. It's everything. If we cannot be genuine in our kind deeds, right, we are lying to ourselves and we're attempting to lie to God. And that just is kind of unconscionable. So all that to say that when we create structures that cause some kind of peer pressure or ingratiation in as an attempt to make someone a Christian,
that's proselytization.
It is.
Not evangelism.
And but the reason we do it somewhat is we don't believe that the gospel is enough. You know, and honestly, I just think that if we spent the energies on saying, are we really communicating this clearly? Is it being heard as God would have it be heard? Mm-hmm. We ask those questions instead of how do we get a hearing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we're just careful to make sure that we are contextualizing and we're expressing it in a way that it can be heard in the society where we are. Okay. And then we're equipping everybody we know, everyone who's a believer, to just clearly state the gospel without any kind of varnish. To do it clearly, quickly, frequently, because the gospel is the only thing that's going to reveal the called. You know, from my understanding, now here's how I see it. Okay. That the only... So I think in every society there are believers waiting to be born.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are not going to become apparent until they hear the message. That the only test for whether somebody, let's say you're standing over a crowd of 10,000 people, and in this society it just happens that five of them are called. Let's just say that that's all there is at that moment. The only way to find those five people is to tell them the story. There's no other way. And if we spend a ton of time trying to get those who are not called, and I don't see that as some kind of eternal, well, it's from eternity, but it's based on foreknowledge, and I think it changes over time. Like, of those 10,000 people, there'll be somebody else that's called later. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Even though they aren't called today.
This is about the same as saying these are those who are good soil.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So how do you find the good soil? It seems
you got to plant the seed.
Yeah. The sower is very reckless. He's not spending a whole lot of time in horticulture. He's just throwing seed. Mm-hmm. And I know we had to be careful about reading too much into the parables. But if you look at the balance of the New Testament, it seems to be that there's just a very wide scattering and a willingness to just get up and leave, right? Jesus mm-hmm. is like, go to the towns and villages, tell them that the kingdom is near. Those who hear you, stay with them. Don't greet people on the road. You know, go to the village, stand in the square, tell them that the kingdom is here. Those one or two people that listen, stay in their house, you know, eat their food, sleep on their couch, tell them about the kingdom. Move on. Mm-hmm. You know, you go there, you proclaim it, nobody hears it, knock the dust off your feet, next village. There's a very wide scattering of the seed initially. Okay, so, and I think that what happens and what we've wasted a lot of time on, I think, historically, is in attempting to evangelize where maybe that society's not called. Maybe they need more prayer, maybe they need a couple of martyrs. You know, so maybe you're there just to be the martyr, to be honest. You know, I think that Tertullian, when he said that the blood of the martyrs is seed, wasn't being romantic.
Yeah. I think that's it literally is. Sowing the seed of the gospel.
I think it literally is. Yeah, I think that there are places that, you know, I think about like Jim Elliot and his dying there and then his wife coming and the whole tribe converting. I don't think that's for nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens time and time again. Brian Hogan, who you know, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if his little son that died would be considered a martyr, you know, but he's buried in the soil there. Mm-hmm. And somehow
it played
after
a part.
That, mm-hmm. it just kind of all blew up. It exploded. And he attributes it to just them seeing how they grieved. And I'm sure that's part of it, mm-hmm. but it certainly was part and parcel of the kind of the breakthrough, mm-hmm. you know, that there's some sort of a cost that's paid, and I'm not saying that we buy our way through, but I do think that God honors those sacrifices and that he acts in the people where we show the kind of love that he has for them. He will show up. So that all that to say is that it seems that God's missionary methods are wide proclamation. They are obviously a lot of prayer, both leading and following the proclamation, and that they are martyrdom and not necessarily dying, but suffering mm-hmm. Deeply, you know, in that context. Those things seem to have the effect so that God becomes the one. So when Paul says, I came to Corinth and I knew nothing but Christ and him crucified, right? Mm-hmm. That there's this thing, but you know, how is he doing that? Well, it's because Jesus comes to him in a dream or whatever and says, don't be afraid. I have many people in this city. Well, what do you mean? You know, there's no Christians here. But that what he's saying is those called, they're ready. Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't think they were there, but the only way to find them, the only way to know they're there, is to tell them the message. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say that really the focus ought to be: are we telling this well? Are we clear on our own message? Are we living our own message? Not for the sake of proving it to somebody. But do we actually believe it? If we don't, we don't need to be telling it, mm-hmm. you know?
Because there is that other element of people come in, people see how we are living, or people come into our assembly and see how we love one another, or they experience God in our midst in some way, mm-hmm. which is not, you know, benevolence. It's not the, it doesn't seem to be the same, fall into the same trap as you were describing.
Right.
But it is important that we are authentic, not just that we have this message, but that we are living it.
Yes.
And that we're a community that lives it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see a whole lot of church staff meetings or growth seminars that say, you know what you need? You need to just tell people's secrets when they get there. You know, it's just like, just read their mail, you know, that Paul, you know, he speaks of someone walking into the assembly and having this powerful experience, but it's when there's this charismatic, if you will, kind of experience where someone is prophesying and they're actually saying what's going on in that person's life. Mm-hmm. John Wimber in his book, What is the Power of Evangelism, I think he typifies a lot of that. And I haven't read the second half of it, but in the first half, you know, he tells us this experience where, you know, they had this spiritual breakthrough. They believe that the kingdom's in our midst and that it's the gospel of the kingdom. And he tells us a story where he's sitting in an airplane and across the aisle from him, there's a man and he feels a prompting of God's spirit, say, ask him about Janet. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And he just says, hey, I know this is strange, but I'm supposed to ask you about Janet. And the guy just turns white as a sheet. And where'd you hear that name and all this, you know, and apparently that's his mistress. And he's just completely convicted and becomes a believer in Christ on this airplane. You know, that doesn't happen every day. You know, like if I decide, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn and talk to this person about Jesus. Not bad, not wrong. Chances of that person becoming a Christian by the end of your flight is not good. But, you know, where God shows up, it's a lot better, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and that gets back, I guess that gets to some of the other exhortations. But, the first one is if we have a very deep confidence in the gospel and what it's supposed to do and its power, I think we can take an approach much closer to what the apostles did. I'm not saying we should do it because they did it, but they did it because, you know, when Paul goes and he's in Galatia for 2 weeks, he's in Thessalonica for 3 weeks, he's leaving churches behind after only a very limited exposure. He doesn't necessarily always have to come back and superintend. I think he leaves Timothy in Ephesus. That's about as close as he gets to some sort of a kind of an oversight role. He seemed to see himself as just planting indigenous churches that could self-govern, self-regulate, especially, you know, as he goes back, he appoints elders in every town, stuff like that. But it's from those people. He just sees that the gospel is this catalyzing agent that just draws, you know, it just awakens what's latent within that society and pulls it together into these colonies of a community that he can trust are going to be okay under God's oversight directly. So he had a ton of faith in his own message to not be that broken cistern, but to facilitate, you know, this experience of living waters, this thing that's self-perpetuating in a people and expanding even. So that's why I think we as a church, we as individuals should think more about and really have a heart check and say, do I really believe this message, you know, or have I let familiarity breed contempt? Mm-hmm. You know, because I'll just be honest, you know, there are times when I'm like, I'm not telling that guy, he's way too far gone. Yeah, but what, you know, what we're dealing with, what we're distributing is life from death. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking for the people who are too far gone. Mm-hmm. And that what we have the only hope for those people. But do we believe that? You know, I just think that all of us, if making a disciple or however we want to frame it, was just a matter of telling someone this story, and we didn't make too much of it. You know, we weren't like, well, first start with this question and then do this and then, you know, but we just said, look, do you believe the story? You know, is this something that's important to you? Did this change your life? Can you tell this story to somebody else? That's it. You know, if I'm no longer responsible for somebody else's response other than just to pray for them, that means that I can tell it more readily, more freely. I don't have to be as weird about it. You know, we get really weird about telling the gospel when we're responsible for what the other person does with it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're afraid of somehow my presentation is going to mess it up. That puts way too much on our shoulders and makes it much less likely that we'll actually just say the words. But if we know that this is life-giving power, I think it would probably fuel a lot more missionary enterprises as we tell this message and we look around and we go, okay, you know, where are the really lost people? And then we get on an airplane, you know, we acquire whatever skills are needed to have a job there. We get a few close friends and, you know, we all just rotate out doing day labor while the others go and preach, you know. We can find ways to get there without having to have a whole organization and raise funds and, you know, create a logo and do graphic design or anything. You know, we don't need a website to reach the world. I mean, I like websites, but I'm saying that we can just tell the story. And if we say, well, I'm just going to keep telling this until I find a place where people really want to hear it, that may mean that we move around a lot. You know, so anyway, I think that just changes a lot of how we approach church growth. And there we go, Kent.
Evangelize.
Yeah, you said we weren't going to get through all of them, and you were right.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, we did one.
We did one. One
evangelize. Don't proselytize, right, people. If you have questions for us about this, you can email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.